final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no one has gone before.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ramblecast. I'm your host, Chris Cesarano, and joining me today is my very favorite Canadian, Jerry.
Hello, hello.
And a very, very special guest today, we have Sean Elysium Sands in the house. Woo!
Yay! I love me.
I'm awesome. No, this is going to my head. You need to not let me do that.
Yes, we have Sean Sands from Game of the Jobs here. So, and part of the reason is because once upon a time he wrote something. What was it? I think it was a week ahead.
Yes.
Item where you were discussing Let's Plays, and I had a very, very, very negative opinion about Let's Plays on the whole.
And I would call it openly hostile. Maybe no.
No, that's actually that's pretty accurate. Actually, it is still also openly hostile, and we actually wanted to have a time to at some point discuss it. And the not long after we recorded our last episode, I had the thought that I wanted to discuss the role of things like YouTube and streaming in the games media today, and how games media is kind of changing. And I figured this would be a perfect opportunity for us to discuss that. But in the in all that time of thinking and seeing some of the news coming up in the intervening weeks, I also realized that this is probably a good opportunity for me to just kind of get out of my own head and actually try and be objective about this whole matter, because sometimes just really to get a little too into your own, well, this is how I think the world should be. So what I actually wanted to start with, though, is seeing if we could try and track down how and when video content and all really did start to become such a big thing with games journal and games media. Because I recall there's games trailers existed for a while, and one of the more notable ones I would think of would actually be Zero Punctuation.
Yeah, I don't know if that's... Yeah, I think there's a connection there. I think the question of video as a medium for communication, in my mind, squares a little differently than the idea of sort of streaming content and Let's Plays and stuff like that. It's interesting. I actually get to, over the past couple of weeks, think about this in my real 9-to-5 job and got to do some speaking on it. And so I've done more thinking since we've talked about it. And one of the things that I think is this is ultimately tied into is a trend I think occurs online, and that has occurred online over the last 10 to 15 years is sort of the natural extension of that, which is if you look at sort of, from my point of view, if you look at sort of any communication method, any sort of technology, and I would extend this even to created media like music or like movies or like journalism and articles and things like that, there has been a steady progress in technology to trim out middleman, trim out a filter through which things are projected and lenses through which they're projected. So if you look at like the recording industry, 20 years ago, we all know the story that you couldn't even like buy one song, much less buy things digitally or, subscribe to services. And over time, those sort of middlemen, those filters have been removed down and removed down and removed down. And obviously, like in the mainstream, you have things like Spotify and Pandora now. But even independently, you have sort of this, almost collaborative creation of music. Independent artists have accessibility in ways they never have. And that connection of a person, a receiver, to an experience is becoming really relevant. And I think where I'm going with this, finally, to bring it back, is I think that Twitch and things like that are a reflection of that, that desire to remove filters and remove barriers between a person's experience with an item and the digital projection of that. So, which is why I think if you look at Let's Plays, you can't just have a Let's Play where you just play the video game. It has to be contextualized by somebody talking about it or living through it or sort of having an experience that's reflected in those Let's Plays. And it comes off sometimes, if you look at somebody like PewDiePie, it feels superficial at times. But I think there's a broad range of those sort of contextualizations, and that's what makes it interesting. If I go to Twitch, as much as anything, I'm watching the game because I enjoy it, but I want to experience that game through someone else's eyes and somebody I relate to, and that's the key second part that I think really makes it relevant and kind of connects into the broader trend digitally.
Now, I find it interesting that you say removes the middleman, because in a lot of ways, when you really think about it, like a lot of services, like be it Amazon, MP3, or even something like Bandcamp, then Twitch and YouTube, it feels more like in some cases you're actually adding middlemen, because if you see for a lot of musicians, when they break down sales, like what percentage of sales goes to the artists for these different services, a lot of times buying the physical CD will still be better for the artist than buying the MP3, because now some of those proceeds have to go to Amazon in addition to going to the record industry. Now everything's also cheaper, so it ends up being – but then again, I also imagine you could argue that in some ways with markup for a physical storefront versus just ordering the physical CD.
Well, it's not a perfect system, but I think where you see, you know, where you see opportunities happening as well is you can't go through this sort of traditional system of I'm going to sell you the end product of my content. That's not the sales point now. It's actually but there is an opportunity if you're a musician or a video producer or a game player to say, I'm going to create content and create media, and then maybe I get you to support that through Kickstarter, or maybe I get you to support that through Patreon, or maybe I have, I attach ads to it, or if I'm with Twitch, you know, maybe I have the subscription model. There's still middlemen in there, but they aren't really, they aren't in the same way barriers. So when I'm talking about that, what I'm talking about is really barriers to content.
Gatekeepers.
Yeah, exactly. There's still people who are going to figure out how to stick their fingers in the pie, but it doesn't block the information in the same way.
Yeah, essentially you don't necessarily have someone in a suit saying, we don't have examples of this doing well in the public eye, therefore we're not going to support it. It actually gives someone else some of the chance to go out there, put it out there, and let people decide for themselves. Theoretically.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about things like YouTube and that, and that I've actually always found interesting, is that YouTube doesn't a lot of people do who do the YouTube for a living do just sort of, they put ads on their videos, and YouTube takes a piece of that, and a lot of them are with networks that take another piece of that and everything else. But the thing that I've always found interesting is that YouTube still to this day will let you put up videos and turn the ads off if you want. So there are a couple of because there's been a lot of discussion lately among larger YouTubers talking about how, much like what has happened with a lot of websites in recent years, the amount of money they can make from ads is tanking because there's not as many people advertising, because a lot of people use ad block, and the ones who don't usually pay attention to the ads anyway. So the ads are worth a lot less, and there's a lot less of them. So even the really popular people on YouTube or even on Twitch or something are making a lot less than they used to. So a lot of channels like Lazy Game Reviews is one who does this. Jim Sterling does it to a degree as well. They will fund either some or all of their content from something like Patreon. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, because I'm doing this, if I hit over X amount of money per month, I'll just turn the ads off on YouTube. And you can actually do that,
yeah.
Which is kind of, I've always found kind of interesting, is that you can just turn the ads off and say, I'm still going to use YouTube, but I'm not going to rely on it to make my living, which is definitely something that's a little bit different from how we've traditionally seen stuff like this made before. There, YouTube is still a gatekeeper of sorts, but they don't have the stranglehold on your output that perhaps other things could. But it's interesting as well, because the big shift that we've seen in the last number of years with the rise of YouTube, and places like Giant Bomb technically beat a lot of these people to it even sooner than that, is that we're starting to see now a lot of, I guess the buzz term for it is personality-driven content, which is that you're not, and this is something I think Jeff Gerstmann from Giant Bomb saw before a lot of other people did, which is that you're not going to a site anymore. You're not going to consume content from a site necessarily. You're going to consume content from a particular person, and you know that person, you know their personality, you know what their tastes are. They might happen to write or do video for X site, and maybe by going there to see them, you'll find something else. But you're not going to, like, Game Trailers, for example, because it's Game Trailers. You're going there to see a particular thing that happens to live there.
I'd say that would be more or less Screw Attack there. And as I said, like, yeah. I mean, you quote Giant Bomb. I feel that whoever was at the Escapist when they got Zero Punctuation on board,
that
whoever
was made Russ that. Pitts.
I mean, that was Russ Pitts who got him. Yeah,
that was his decision.
Yep. Yeah,
I believe he found him. EIC at the time. Yeah,
yeah, that was a great decision because I feel like that was the first step. Because I mean, at the time, the Escapist was always trying to differentiate themselves like everyone else. And I see it. I've seen it too, man. The past several years, like everyone wants to start a new gaming site and they want it to be news, reviews, and previews. And it's like everyone's doing that. Why are you going to? And the Escapist, they always wanted to be different. They wanted to focus on features. And now they're doing a lot of news, reviews, and previews, but they also got a lot of that extra multimedia content. I feel like they were always ahead of that curve there.
Yeah.
And now, though, again, like at the time, technically the Escapist would have been a gatekeeper or something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because not as many people were putting stuff up on YouTube.
Yeah, I think
well, and it was funny. Yahtzee started on he actually started on YouTube originally. He did like two videos there, but this was in 2007 when the whole concept of monetizing on YouTube the way it exists now was not really a thing. Like if he started in 2010, he probably could have just lived off YouTube and he wouldn't have gone to another site, but at this time you couldn't really do that. So, yeah, Russ found his stuff cuz he had his first two episodes kind of went viral and he was like, "Hey, we'll pay you to put this over here."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, meanwhile it's almost 8 years. I can't believe it's been bloody 8 years that he's been doing that thing, but he's still going somehow. Yeah. He's still going.
Sometimes it seems like he doesn't want to, but
yeah, I know.
I can imagine that's got to get a little old at some point. You know, not necessarily. I mean, people still clearly love it, but you know, it's creating the same thing for 8 years. You must love it a bit.
I look at it this way because it's like when you talk to people about something like, say, Penny Arcade, mm-hmm. that comics, the sense of humor has actually shifted quite a bit and the writing style has shifted quite a bit over since 1998 that's been there versus, Zero Punctuation. It feels like people want it to be a specific way. So it's possible that when you do have this personality driven, like Zero Punctuation is a specific style with a specific personality behind it. And it's one that after 8 years has to be tiresome because people don't remain the same. People change over time. Personalities shift slightly. So at this point, like, does he really want to be doing that? And it does make you wonder if some of these personalities will want to be doing this 8 years from now.
Well, and I think that's part of what I was trying to get at earlier. Like, I mean, you're absolutely right that there's still sort of until we figured out the right model for this structure, there's going to be lots of back and forth, and there's going to be people sort of, you know, hedging or, you know, does, you know, traditional advertising work? Is it more of a supportive model? It's all these other questions. But if you were Yahtzee, and you hadn't gone with the Escapist and you were doing your own thing, you'd actually have a lot more autonomy to make decisions like that about who you are, how you represent yourself, how often you keep going down this road. I mean, you know, I think I met him once, but I certainly don't know what his, you know, whether he is tired of it, whether he'd like to do something else, what the influences are. But I'm certain that there's some degree of pressure or pushback to say, this is what people want. This is what they want to see you do. This is what we're paying you to continue doing. Please continue to do this. You know, I again, it may not be that, but my guess would be, even if it wasn't for him, in a lot of cases, when you have this sort of structure that is mandating to some degree what your content is, how it looks, and how it's shaped, you are giving up that autonomy. And that is, those are the kinds of barriers I'm talking about being broken down. So, you know, if PewDiePie, like him shutting down comments is a great example, because this was what, last year, you know, the sort of most popular YouTuber out there sort of shut down his comments and said, I'm not going to do that anymore. That's not who I am. It makes me not enjoy this. It makes me, I don't like what I'm getting out of those, and I don't see the value of it. He can just sort of make that decision. He is ultimately responsible to his viewers, and if his viewers go down, that may impact him, but he has the autonomy in the decision making. It doesn't have to eventually kind of run that through a process of, whether, like a board member or a boss or something like that. And that would be, that's both the blessing and the curse of these things, which is, you get to make the decisions, but you also get the opportunity to screw up really, really bad.
An example of when we were discussing this through email a little bit ahead of time, Eric Hansen, or Wordsmith on Game of the Jobs, editor, mm-hmm. actually brought up the idea that for a lot of people, you need an editor. And it's something that, I agree with it. As I told everyone there, if I could, I'd have like Eric everywhere where it's like, I wrote a thing. It's not for Game of the Job, but it's a thing. Here, edit it. Because it is very nice to have that other pair of eyes that understands, especially, good language, good communication, to read through and be like, okay, you're doing stupid stuff here and there.
Well, that's the big knock on Let's Plays and streams, isn't it, to some degree, which is that ultimately the content is extraordinarily sketchy. It's way hit or miss, and a lot of these personality-driven environments don't actually – depending on your perspective and depending on who you are and depending on what you like, don't seem to offer
subjective.
Very much. Yeah, super subjective. Like, I'm not trying to put them all in.
No, it's true,
I think we've all been there. Like, you turn on, like, why is anybody watching this? This is terrible.
Why is this popular?
My first exposure to PewDiePie was during, I think it was the Spike Video Game Awards or something. They had him playing Dying Light. I didn't even know who he was. It was just some random guy playing a game and completely ruining anything about the game for me. That's basically my assessment of it. But at the same time, my first actual real exposure to Let's Plays, and I don't give it enough fair credit, or at least Let's Plays in general enough fair credit when I'm discussing them, is Seamus Young and his crew did the series Spoiler Warning, where it's a group of them discussing the game, and they're discussing its flaws, they're discussing, critically what's going on with it, as well as just having a goofy old time. So it felt more like a podcast, but with that mixture of commentary. And to me, one of the questions that comes around, especially now, of Let's Plays is whether they fall under fair use or not. And I feel like Spoiler Warning very much does, because they may be playing the game, but there's still that critical aspect to it. They're not just playing the game for the sake of, hey, watch me play this game, isn't it great? We find this part fascinating, or we find this part terrible, and here's the ensuing discussion as to why. And I feel like there's room for that in a lot of ways. Even before Let's Plays, I think, were a thing, you had YouTube videos of people like, here's achievement hunters. Here's how you do all of this to get these achievements for this game. You could have guides in a sense, and that's where, again, when we were discussing with Japanese games and everything, Dark Souls, where that blew up. It's, in some ways, guides, and in some ways, it's just... And, of course, there's also the comedy factor. Like, who was it? Jeff Green, you guys recently had, that has the highlight video of his deaths?
Which is wonderful. I can watch Jeff Green die all day.
And there's even weird stuff. There's other weird stuff, too, that some of these guys will do. Like, there's a streamer who's famous for doing this. Somebody, when I was at work today, sent me a video of this, of a guy who beat the final boss in Bloodborne using a Guitar Hero controller. And
is that the same guy?
It's friggin' savant like when I saw that, but I was like, holy crap. But stuff like that at the same time, is a lot of these guys have, some of these are just guys who, and this is really dependent on what you like. Some guys are sort of goofballs like PewDiePie is, like a lot of his audience is kids from what I understand. And you have people who do sort of more serious stuff, like they have fun with it, but they're trying to provide, interesting commentary and that. When I watch a stream, that's the kind of stuff I'm usually into, but some of these guys who do stuff in a gimmicky way as well are that way as well. Cause that's the thing with a lot of these guys is some of them try to be either critics or to be, to cover the game in a more traditional way, but a lot of them are really, can be more considered entertainers who just happen to use video games as their medium,
But this is where I get nervous about the the criticism, because I like there's tons of these things I don't. My kids watch this guy Stampy, who does Minecraft videos. I can't stand it. I can't stand it. Yeah. I'm in that same boat where what I really want is somebody sort of looking at the game through a critical eye, or really pointing out something about the structure over there, the way it presents stuff. And I think we're all sort of on board. Not everybody, but I think most of us are on board with saying, you know what, when somebody brings that level of analysis and detail to it, then that seems like it crosses that threshold of being fair use, that okay, they're providing something. But then you look at somebody else and say, oh, well, that I don't like. That's fine not to like it, but to kind of then connect that to say that doesn't rise to a high enough level in my standard to say that it is fair use or isn't fair use. You know, when they're the question of the quality of the broadcast is the determining factor of whether it should exist. I get real nervous about that because, you know, it smacks a little bit of potentially being elitism, or, you know, just because I don't like the guy, or I don't find him funny, or I don't think his jokes are very good, or he has an annoying voice, or, you know, I really don't like this guy. like, those are all things that are sins as far as me individually, but I actually think he's still contributing something that's for a different audience and is as valid to broadcast these games as anybody else. If you're going to take him down, you should take the whole thing down. And if you're not going to take, you know, this really high quality broadcast over here, then you can't sort of project a quality level of concern about who should and who shouldn't be, you know, broadcasting. And I'm not saying you guys are doing that, but I feel like that sentiment is out there from time to time.
Oh, no, yeah. Definitely. And that's one of the reasons why I said, you know, I got to get out of my own head, because when you look at it, to view it another way, it's like every E3 where Ubisoft will show a new Just Dance game and you hear all the gamers on Twitter, nobody cares, get rid of this. Mm. And it's like, well, obviously someone cares because it's still selling. Or if Nintendo doesn't do the comments on their directs anymore, or at least not on YouTube when they stream them, but once upon a time when they did, they would have like the chat there, and like you'd see like a new Animal Crossing game get announced, and you'd have like all caps letters, no one cares about Animal Crossing, announce Metroid, announce Zelda, and then like the next statement is someone saying, oh my god, I love Animal Crossing, yes. And it's like, yeah, I mean, people can't get out of their own heads, and you got a lot of gamers that think all gamers are this way, or all gamers should be this way, and yeah, it becomes rough, because as you say, this guy is providing content that does have a use, and with, you know, and it's something that I keep forgetting. I mean, I keep going home and my niece found something new on YouTube, and I kind of blame my mom because she only uses YouTube when she's at grandmom's house, and grandmom doesn't know computers. So
you're watching that internet TV?
Basically. I mean, all the stuff my niece has found. But that's the thing, like, we allowed her to watch, you know, the Alien movies because she's smart enough to handle them. I'm not going to tell you how old she is, but she's smart enough to handle them. But she...
9 months isn't old enough. No, got to get her to go a year. Come on, man. Get better than this.
Fortunately, she's definitely older than that. Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, the first thing she does when she goes online is, I really liked Alien Resurrection. God, she needs taste, but she's like, I really like Alien Resurrection. I'm going to go and search the internet for, like, Alien Resurrection stuff, and she finds a video on YouTube that's, like, 10 things that are wrong with Alien Resurrection. And knowing YouTube, that could be filled with content that is not... I mean, and from my perspective, I will say also, like, because I have a vested interest in this child's growth. I mean, she's not my child, but she is my niece. And so if she's going to be watching something, I want it to be something that is intellectually stimulating or something. And a lot of stuff out there on YouTube isn't.
No.
So it's a question of, like, is this good content for her? Is this going to be something that does help her think about these things? Or is it going to be someone that's just yelling and screaming and cussing really loudly, and, oh, hey, that's funny.
Yeah, I think there's two distinctions to make. One being sort of individual choice and parental rights and making good decisions about, you know, who is influenced by what. But my concern becomes when there's a broader decision made, because the line between something like that, making decisions about what is good enough, you know, what should be sort of censored or cut out or and I know you're not promoting censorship, but it could be taken that way. I mean, the difference between, you know, that's essentially a version of the same, you know, discussion about, oh, we shouldn't have Mark Twain books in the school library because I feel like it will influence these kids in a negative way. No, what you should do is make decisions within your own family and sort of, you know, influence around there. But it's when the big decisions get made, you know, about, okay, this is good enough to be archived in the big database, which YouTube and Twitch and all those things ultimately are. They're just sort of the big, gigantic central library with great books and really, really crap books in them as well. And I think those should be preserved. It makes, you know, it makes sense. And then people should be able to choose independently where they go and what they do and what they look at. But I get more and more nervous about these sort of elements of this is good enough, this isn't good enough, or this has some component of a copyrighted material, and so we really need to excise it. Or this does, but it's good enough that we're going to keep it and allow it because we like what it says.
The one thing I will give, you know, even the stuff on YouTube that I don't care for, like a lot of the sort of, you know, screechier Let's Player types and that, is that the one thing, what I do look at when I'm not a fan of that stuff, but I will, especially knowing that a lot of the audience for a lot of those types of guys are young kids, the positive spin I try to put on it as well is these kids who are watching this are getting a lot of exposure to gaming and what's cool about it in a way that, you know, I was never able to when I was a kid, because I had either magazines or being able to play on a computer at a friend's house or something. And I like to think in my mind that a lot of these guys who are going and watching something like PewDiePie are, you know, maybe kids who just haven't been exposed to gaming or don't think there's anything interesting about it, and then see a lot of what he does and goes, oh, that's kind of, you know, that's interesting. I should, you know, I want to do some of that myself. And that hopefully we get more, you know, you do get more young people in the hobby, which will ultimately, you know, hopefully lead to more and better games in the long run. I think it's sort of providing a level of exposure that's really good, and that's not, and that also isn't this sort of, I remember when I was a kid, this was when a lot of the societal conversations were starting to happen about things like Saturday morning cartoons and that, and how very heavily marketing driven and advertising influenced they were, and how, you know, there were so many cartoons when I grew up that were literally conceived as advertisements for toy lines and things like that. And I kind of like the fact that what I think about what a lot of young kids are watching now, if they're watching something like PewDiePie, a lot of his stuff is just him playing a game. It's not driven by advertising. Like, he's playing a game, but he's not actively trying to market it to them. It's just them sort of taking in what he's seeing. He's not saying, you know, and today I'm playing this, and he's not getting paid to shill it to people, which I think is a purer way for maybe young minds to consume entertainment. I don't know.
Well, possibly, because I know EA has a program for something like that. I just don't know the specifics of how it works. Like, evidently, they will give money or something.
It's their promo program. If you do promotional content, like brand deals and stuff, EA sort of has a division that does that kind of thing.
See, and that's the thing. I don't know enough about that, so I don't know if you'd be involved in anything or what shape it would look like.
It's basically doing they actually did some of the advertising around Battlefield Hardline, which recently came out, was involved in that some way. They actually had some video ads that were on websites that were actually done by large Battlefield, like, YouTubers or streamers, people who play that a lot, where they were doing, like, clip reels and stuff like that as part of the advertising. It was very clearly, like, designated as such, but that's kind of what their program is. It's about using these personalities to help promote stuff, but the thing that I'm liking is there's been some scandals around this in the last year, but the YouTube audience seems to be a lot of the bigger YouTubers are being very good about making it very clear when something that they put up as an advertisement. And the main reason they're doing that, which gives me some more faith in the audience about, is largely because the audience is demanding that. Like, they demand to be told when they're getting advertised to, because the audiences will turn on a YouTuber if they if they do something that's advertorial content and don't tell them that. They'll be like, you mean I just watched a 40-minute ad? Screw you.
I think your two points are really well connected, because what makes these in the good examples and the bad examples, I think what people connect to is that authenticity, that unfiltered view. So even in content where it is, I am getting paid for this, you know, even in those situations, as long as it's completely transparent, people are still getting to see the game in action, how it performs on, you know, that person's computer, on somebody that they sort of know and they can contextualize and enjoy. And as long as that transparency is there, I think most people like you are kind of okay with that. Maybe I will watch it, maybe I won't watch it. In a lot of cases, I do watch it because, you know, it's content in this age where reviews are getting more and more embargoed at release. It's this sort of, in most of these cases, this is content coming out before the game is out. And so that's just a new avenue to make intelligent buying decisions, as far as I'm concerned. Again, as long as it's transparent. But to your other point, which is the fact that people really don't, you know, since a big draw of the entire venture is that level of authenticity, is that unfiltered, people have this sort of automatic guard up of knowing when they're being scammed or feeling betrayed if they didn't know and they find out later. And I think you're absolutely right. It can make and break personalities, and it can take somebody who's definitely trending and heading in the right direction and destroy it. There was a Diablo 3 streamer maybe a year and a half ago who had, and I can't think of his name right now, I think he was Diablo 3, but he had always sort of portrayed himself as being, having a physical disability. He was in a wheelchair. And one time when he thought he was on break, he just stood up and walked out of the room.
Oh, I remember this. Yes.
That guy's gone. He is gone.
He got run out of town for that.
Off the face of the earth, as far as I know.
That. Yes.
Yeah, and that, because precisely for the reason that people are trying to connect with an individual, they're trying to build a level of trust with that individual, and then have that sort of on-air relationship. And he completely betrayed that. He completely manipulated people. And it wasn't a situation where you just get to come back and go, oh, you know, sorry about that. Or you have a corporation backing you, like, ABC or CBS or ESPN or somebody like that says, well, we put him on without pay for a whole week, and we're our PR department is going to really amp up things, right? It's that one-to-one connection. And it holds broadcasters accountable in an interesting way.
Yeah. Like, one of the things that that Total Biscuit talks about a lot, because I followed his stuff for a long time, and he's the YouTube stuff that I do, which is really just a hobbyist thing, was kind of inspired by the type of format that he does. But he's talked in the past on some vlogs and stuff that he's done about how this sort of personality-driven thing can be – it can be a blessing and a curse, because it does hold people accountable and keeps people honest in an interesting way, because, you know, you are very unfiltered. We talked about the you need an editor thing. In many cases with YouTubers as well, because it's one guy, they don't have 17 layers of PR between them and the general public, which most people in the general public would see as a good thing, because, you know, people know when they're generally know these days, especially the younger generations, they know when they're getting sold to or when they're being marketed to. And people like that sort of unvarnished thing. But the flip side that he said of that, and it's something he's had a hard time dealing with, is that a lot of your audience, when they consume your stuff enough and they see you talking kind of, you know, in a kind of normal, the way people talk, and especially if they interact with people in their chat or whatever, he said the problem is a lot of people start to see you basically as their friend. And he said it's really tough because he's like, you don't want that level of responsibility. You don't want to feel like you have a friendship level of responsibility or accountability to people who you don't know and who, you know, you've never met and very likely never will meet. You know, he said, my ultimate goal is that I make content, you consume it. And he said he's seen some YouTubers who've had a very hard time keeping that barrier up. And, you know, they'll see things that people say to them, or if someone really goes after them because they feel, like you said, that they've been betrayed in some way over something, you know, maybe definitely less serious than what you described before, but something like that. And they have a very hard time dealing with that because they, you know, someone will indicate that they hurt their feelings, and they'll feel sort of empathetic to that, and they'll feel bad for sort of doing that to their audience, and you have to sort of keep a barrier there, but a lot of them have a very hard time doing that, and that's a challenge as well that you won't necessarily have if you're someone who doesn't interact directly with the audience necessarily. If you're you know, a TV personality on traditional network television who records something and then it's put out there later, and, you know, marketing it and everything else is handled by some other group of people, it's sort of a different thing. And I think that's a problem that a lot of these guys are learning, just because this is such a new thing. You know, I think these are challenges that no one's figured out yet.
I think you're exactly right on the point that it's really related to how new it is. When I hear you mention that, I remember a story I read about the original guy who played Superman back in the early days of TV.
Early days of TV,
like the black and white TV show, but when that medium was still young. And he tells a story about walking down the street or meeting with a number of fans, and this kid, like 9 or 10, pulls a gun on him and wants to shoot him because he wants to see the bullet bounce off. Because the medium is still really, I mean, okay, the kid's really young too and clearly not that bright, but the medium was still really young, so those barriers of understanding the you know, what's real and what's not real, what is sort of portrayed and what is actually real sentiment in that was still developing. And I think, I mean, I think that's fair. I think it extends, you know, I think some personalities are going to be more comfortable and sort of more natural with that than others. But I think there's also that audience ownership side too, which is, which sort of is a problem across the internet. Frankly, that happens as often that still happens in written media and written journalism and, you know, in popular blogs. I think I wouldn't say it's unique to, certainly not to Total Biscuit, but I wouldn't even say it's unique to YouTube overall. And I think it's, you know, it goes back to that PewDiePie decision to shut down comments. And I think that's actually, you know, if it works for him, and it makes his experience better, I think it actually does set up a sort of a good precedent of saying, here's where my barriers are. Here's where my boundaries are. And I, you know, that's just going to be something that sort of has to shake out over time. I will still say that, you know, I do see some people handling that better than others. And I think in the long run, those people will also sort of chart out for future streamers what that looks like. Here's how you relate with your audience in the most positive way that you can control. It's just uncharted territory right now.
Yeah. I think over time, they will start to, as the successful, you know, as the people who are successful at this go forward and more people try it out. Yeah. I think there will become, sort of baselines for this stuff. A lot of people will start to see, you know, well, this is, depending on the type of personality that you want to be, you know, this is the way to do it. This is, you know, this is a good way to interact with your fans to keep that stuff managed. And like, the thing that's been interesting is there's, in some spaces, this stuff has already been shifting. Like, both Total Biscuit and PewDiePie shut down their comments, and other people have thought about it. And the thing that really kind of rocked a lot of YouTubers who hate their comment sections but left them on because they were always under the impression that they had to, is that in both of those, and I mean, yeah, both of these guys are extremely popular already. The same rules, like, I still have my comments on because the same rules don't apply to little guy necessarily. But the one thing that they both said is they is their viewership didn't drop at all.
Yeah.
Because everybody said, oh, if you turn off your comments, your views will go through the floor because no one's going to stick around. And no one wanted to be the first to try it. But then one day they just went, screw this, this is too much. And they turned it off and their viewership basically didn't change. For the worse at all. And they were kind of like, well, that, I wish I'd done this a long time ago. I don't need this. And, you know, in truth be told, you know, both of them have things like where they direct people to go is to, they have their own subreddits, which are heavily moderated and everything else. So they, where they can, you know, keep the cesspool that is YouTube comments much more under control. But it, things like that are already starting to become apparent as well, is that if you don't, you know, if they're the things about YouTube that everybody complains about, you maybe don't have to expose yourself to as much as you might think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is nice.
I feel like the biggest issue with YouTube, and I wouldn't be surprised if, like, I feel like people are actually just waiting for a competitor to YouTube in some ways, like, or especially if you're using it to create content. Because, I mean, even as a user, like, I'm more, like, I've been more and more enraged as they've kind of tried to steer me in how I experience YouTube. And now, like, every channel I go to has a what to watch. And if I go to a specific channel for a specific thing, I still have to be told, like, oh, go to these completely unrelated video channels. And even as someone that puts my own content, like, that kind of pisses me off, because that means people are going to come to my channel and then have an advertisement for someone else's stuff. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I'm not making money off of YouTube right now. I don't have it set to that, and I don't think I ever will turn it on for that. But at the same time, it's like I want people to stay on my channel and be like, what else has this guy done? I don't want them jumping to another channel, but YouTube doesn't really care. They're like, here are the videos we know generate a lot of traffic, which means we can get more ad money on there, so let's get more people going to that. And I feel like if there ever is a competitor to YouTube, I don't know. I don't even know where I'm going with this, but
no, I think it's an interesting question, because I think that, I mean, you can even extend that to think about YouTube instead of as a video service. Think of it as a search engine, which, I mean, it's Google owned, so why not? Why don't we go down that road for a second? If you look at something like a search engine, like Google, who are their customers? Well, it's not the list of websites they bring up. It's not even to some extent their own advertisements, though they're happy to place them, you know, wherever they want. Their customers are the person who searches something and wants the best possible result for the thing they want in that moment to be clearly presented. And the reality is, you know, that I think, you know, what YouTube is trying to leverage then is to say, okay, instead of, you know, they aren't looking at it like a person, you know, or a channel or anything like that. They are saying, you have consumed this media and this media and this media and this media. What does that say about you? So when you finish this, how do I keep you on the site? How do I keep you coming back here? And a lot of times that's not to say, hey, go look at the next thing this same person presented, particularly if it's a situation where it's like, okay, here's another thing this YouTuber created, but it doesn't seem to match the profile we think you are. But I think your point is extremely valid, which is that that's exactly the kind of sort of middleman management, that sort of manipulation, that, you know, that's an incredibly difficult line to walk. And where is YouTube's loyalties in that? Where is their, you know, what bias do they have in making those decisions? And I think people are becoming increasingly skeptical about that. I'm not sure if I said anything either there, by the way, but I think there's 10 ideas in that.
Well, because the problem with the recommendations thing, right, that YouTube has, I mean, their ultimate goal is they don't want you to leave the site, right? They want you just to click on more videos, and they don't really care where they come from, because the ad, you know, as long as the ad plays, they get their piece regardless.
Yep.
But they want to make sure that you're staying in the system in, as long as possible. But I do tend to find that their recommendation system, especially with a lot of what I consume, is very much like Netflix's, which is that I'll watch something.
They got it wrong.
Like, you want to watch this? And I'm like, man, you don't know me at all. why do you think this would make me want to watch this? And I don't think they're very good at keeping me clicking through by showing me stuff that's relevant to me, but that's clearly a bigger technical challenge than I think it should be, but I guess.
Well, it all comes down to algorithms is what it does. And for YouTube, yeah. I feel like there aren't enough – I mean, I think they're getting better. I'm not getting as many recommendations for Let's Plays anymore, but for the most part, like, I'll watch, like, two or three videos that are really, like, I just watched this Sunday or Monday, one of these days, Noah Gervais's, like, two-hour-long analysis of the entire Call of Duty series, and... Oh. I said that's a long thing not a lot of people are going to want to watch, but I found it really great. I found it excellent. And then it's like, you might enjoy. And then it's like, top 10 reasons Call of Duty sucks. Or top, like, or like,
now here's see how the you counterpoint.
Like, five, like, great Call of Duty glitches, or something, or someone ranting about how this pistol is broken in multiplayer. And it's like, that has absolutely nothing to do with what I was watching except for two things. It's Call of Duty and it's video games. And so there needs to be, I think, additional layers of the algorithm there. Because technically, I mean, if I'm watching this guy's lengthy but intelligent critical analysis of Call of Duty, then clearly what I'm wanting to watch is critical analysis of media. But there's no real category for that. That's not how they expect people to shop for this stuff.
Yeah, part of the problem too, right, is that the way a lot of this search stuff works is it's all done by keywords. And the problem is the keywords are all set by the people what post the videos. And there's nothing that ensures that they post, you know, stuff that's accurate necessarily. So that Call of Duty, or that, not even necessarily that they don't post stuff that's accurate. A lot of people don't know how to keyword videos correctly. When I started doing YouTube, it took me 6 months to figure out how to keyword stuff in a way that made sense, rather than just shotgun a bunch of terms into it. And that's the thing, is that, you know, a lot that those two different Call of Duty videos that you talked about have very little to do with each other. But I bet if you used one of the tools that will show you all the keywords, they share almost all the same ones, because the people who put them up went, well, these make sense, I guess. And that's where YouTube is pulling all that stuff from. And that unfortunately relies on both the virtuous intent and the knowledge, you know, of the system that the video creators are putting up. And the big popular savvy ones are well aware of all that. But, you know, the hobbyists or up and comers don't necessarily. But that kind of, it's not a good solution, because that kind of breaks the system.
Yeah.
I think there's another piece too. I think that's absolutely true. I think there's another piece here, which is, so let's say I take you and I take nine other people who have just watched a Call of Duty video of some kind. So you've just watched this long one, and I don't know what these other nines have done. Now I present them with a list of top 10 Call of Duty fails, and you all have to go click on it. You're unhappy. No question. You're like, this.
But they're happy.
Are they? Probably not. So flip it. Now it's you and these same nine people. You've all just watched a Call of Duty video, and I'm like, here is this other hour-long analysis of, you know, that, you know, kind of in-depth sort of frame-by-frame, you know, intelligent deep analysis thing. How fast are they out of that video? Like, click, nope, and they're
really
gone.
Fast.
You're there for the whole hour. You're like, this guy's awesome. I love this.
Hey,
so,
hey, let's be clear. 2 hours, okay?
You know, I'm out. Even I'm out. but the point is, you know, I mean, particularly thinking in the context of, think of all the YouTube comments you've seen, and I realize that may be the vocal minority, but I don't think I share a lot of cultural connections with some percentage of those individuals. More often than not, they're right. Probably more often than not, those suggestions that come up are things that keep people on the site and keep people going to things, you know, going through the system, going through that funnel down the rabbit hole to wherever. Probably isn't for you, but you're consuming, I mean, just sort of, and I experience this too, Jerry, I assume you do too, just because sort of the nature of our involvement with the gaming scene as a medium and as almost a course of study, we interpret all of these things in a context that is like exists among probably what 5% of viewers. We're just absorbing it and interested in elements. that I don't think everybody is. Now, hopefully, I think probably a lot of people listening to this, and hopefully a lot of people who are listening to our show, that's, you know, that's why I like these things, because then I can go find like-minded people who sort of share this, and then I can have a conversation with them. But at the same time, and I'm just guessing here, I'm guessing you're not getting 10 million downloads on this episode, even though I'm on it. Even though I'm, you know, it's terrible. See, you filled my head way too big. But nor would you want to. Would you really want that if 9.9 million of those shared no sort of cultural connection with you? They were hoping you'd just bust into, and now my top 10 fails in Battlefield. Or do you, you know, you're more likely to kind of have the conversation with this smaller community that certainly sympathizes with the reality of your situation, but who probably doesn't represent the majority of what people want to consume.
And I will.
And
I
hope that doesn't sound like elitist. I'm not trying to off in that way.
I just hate that term. And that I think people use it too much, because it's like, I mean, let's face it. Their value judgments are useful. I mean, some things. I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't know any way to actually go further with that without sounding like an asshole either. But
yeah, no, but I mean, the point is, I think these other things do have value. Like, it's clear that a lot of people love the video of the top 10 fails. And I gotta admit, sometimes maybe I've had a few drinks, maybe I do click on it, maybe I do check it out, you know? watch me flip this Grand Theft Auto car all the way up on top of this building. Okay, yeah, this time I'm in. YouTube, you got me.
And I'll confess, I also watched the video when when all Xbox Ones had a Kinect of the guy in Call of Duty that named himself Xbox Off.
Oh, yeah, I totally watched that. I laughed my ass off. I won't deny it.
That is a fantastic video.
I was.
And yet, I mean, and that's the reality. Like, I understand that. You know, Noah Gervais, and I've seen it too. I mean, I follow people like Noah, and I mention them all the time. Noah Gervais, Aaron Signal, Mr. B-Tongue, Matthew Matosis, The Gaming Brit. Like, these are people that, well, The Gaming Brit less so, but these are mostly people that have intellectually driven and mostly dry videos in comparison. They'll have humor, but it's not, like, delivered with that being the primary hook. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is actually, that's part of the surprise, and I can only guess it's because of the, maybe it's the Let's Play format, but Total Biscuit has a lot of subscribers, considering he actually has a bit of a dry style to his delivery for a lot of his gameplay videos that I've seen.
It's maybe critically focused. It's not focused so much on entertainment as being actual criticism.
Well, he I'd say consumer driven. It's consumer advice.
Yeah, buyer's guide, I think, is the term he uses. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually where, I mean, to bring this back to what was actually technically the original topic, the role of games media, like these things as games media, and I actually think Total Biscuit is probably one of the closest things to what a consumer-driven game review ought to be. Really out there in the games industry, because I've watched, I mean, his videos aren't necessarily for me, but I view myself as a games critic. Therefore, what I want to play and what I want to buy is kind of driven by, you know, not only just what I find to be interesting, but I'm going to be honest, I still kind of want to play the Yaiba Ninja Gaiden Z game because it looks fascinating to write about as a complete train wreck of a game. There is no other reason for me to want to play that game, and yet I'm interested in it. Why? Because I have different interests than just being a consumer. Whereas Total Biscuit, like, I watch his stuff and it's like he is very consumer driven. I mean, I watched his video recently. He put up for Mortal Kombat 10, the PC version, is bugged to the point that people are locked out of content. So his advice is do not buy this game until they've fixed it. And even then, like, honestly, wait for like a price drop, because to him, it's and it makes sense. It's like, this game is not worth a consumer's $60 because it doesn't work. And that is good consumer advice, I think, because that is reporting and showcasing, you know, even if technically it's a good game, it's broken. And you don't want someone to buy a broken product. Versus how many reviews out there, written or video, are, and granted, like, you can never get away from subjectivity, but are basically, well, I think this game isn't really all that good, so 7 out of 10. and there's no real actual consideration for the consumer, for your audience. It's as if, like, your opinion should be what your audience's opinion is, or I mean, and then in my case, I'm just writing for the simple – I'm not writing for consumer advice. That's not my audience.
Well, I think that's – I think you're, what you're nailing down there is really why I like the existence of Let's Plays. And Total Biscuit's an interesting example. I think what I like about it is two things. One, that experience of being playing the game, delivering the game. It's in you're seeing the game in action, and then you have and then you find a personality who reflects the things that you're interested in. So I totally get the Total Biscuit analysis. It turns out I don't connect with him. He and I aren't similar enough where I would go to his web, you know, his YouTube series and watch it and make buying decisions, even though he's absolutely right. He's absolutely – Mortal Kombat's clearly a broken game. You're probably right. You shouldn't get your $60 worth. But there are so many other, you know, choices out there, and it's almost like a reviewer too. Like there's all these different sites, and particularly back in the day where it really felt like reviews had a lot of diversity, and you'd go to this magazine because it presented the game in this way, or you'd go to this magazine because it really got to the key points and it had a big number score. You went to this one because you had heard this personality on a podcast and you just really connected with them. It's about finding somebody who reflects your point of view and reflects sort of who you are and how you identify, and you get that by watching how they play the game. You get that by watching how they communicate with their audience and the things that they highlight that are important to them. And maybe it's just the comedy of it, and that's what I want to connect with. Looks like this guy's having a blast. I like his sense of humor. Therefore, as he's playing this game and I'm seeing it work as he's playing it, I'm now interested. Or this guy who's got a really great critical eye and is thinking of it from, you know, X perspective. So I have the viewers I watch. I like people, like, for me, it's like I watched Day 9, who's, you know, this, you know, he's sort of a polarizing figure as well. But I think he really? Had a little bit. I think people, that's a whole different issue. But I've always loved his enthusiasm, his positivity, and his he has a passion and a love for games. And, you know, that some people I think find off-putting. Some people find it like, oh, God, he's just – here he goes cheerleading again. But I find it really authentic and like that he seems to find the joy in games. It makes me find the joy in the games he's playing, and then I get interested in the games he's interested in. Or even somebody like Trump SC, who's a really a solid Hearthstone player. I don't want to play Hearthstone. I've watched him play Hearthstone. I like who he is. I like that he likes the game, but I understand and connect with him enough to know that the things that are attracting him are not the things that are going to attract me. Now, to be fair, I also learned it the hard way by playing Hearthstone and I didn't like it. But that's a whole – I mean, that was to no fault of his or any other broadcaster. I kind of went in knowing that, you know, okay, I've seen it. I might not be in for this. The point is to find the reason I like the personality-driven component of it married up with a video game component of it is that you can use these individuals in the best cases to make an informed buying decision by creating them as sort of proxies. If you can build trust, if you think they're being authentic with you, that they're not, you know, being manipulated by an advertising campaign in the background, then I love that that's out there and that's an option, and that I don't have to be pushed into a way that I'm supposed to be perceiving games, but I can go find the individual who perceives games in the way I do, follow them, watch what they play, and make good decisions, hopefully.
And you actually hit something on there that I have noticed that a lot of people want to do, or like, because the thing about games is they have grown, and while technically they've kind of games have roughly stayed at the same size, hence why AAA budgets are becoming a problem in a lot of ways. I do think that there is a wide and diverse audience, and like you say, like there's a lot of people that want to watch something like Let's Plays, or they want to watch something that makes them laugh, or in my case, I want to watch something that's going to be very much academically enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also a lot of people out there that want to write about and portray, and you definitely get it with YouTube personalities that just have a love of games culture, mm-hmm. where like they want to, like they love the little knickknacks that come out. They love the clothing, or they love creating, like people that love creating the little sprite things. Like I don't know if you've seen them at conventions, but there are tables of these people that create the little sprite recreations. Or I don't know where he's actually located, but in just about every East Coast convention I've been at, there's the guy named Square Painter who does paintings that everything's meant to look pixelated.
I think I have seen that.
Just stuff like that, where it's people that just they like. There's a love of games culture, and that's something that a lot of people look for. Mm-hmm. So, and that's one of those things too, where now that there's fewer gatekeepers out there, you have this accessibility where people are like, I want to find someone on Etsy that's making, you know, game-themed clothing or game-themed, like, coffee mugs kind of a thing. And that even there is its own market that I don't think a lot of people think about when it comes to, okay, we want to discuss games in what way. There's just this whole cultural aspect to it now.
Yeah.
And I'm also just thinking right now. I mean, it is getting time for us to wrap up, and we still technically have not even gotten to.
Okay, let's take a stab at it.
Yeah, the role of writing in the future, because what did inspire this conversation as a whole was Total Biscuit essentially talking as if the regular, I don't want to say print, though it's kind of similar. I mean, like physical print. Kind of dead. Egon was right about that in Ghostbusters. But digital print with web, like a lot of people are even saying with the advent of YouTube, like that is obsolete now. And that's one of those things that I find very curious, because if anything, like I think the big draw for things like YouTube and Twitch, a lot of it is the personalities, but I wouldn't say that is a fault of the digital format that you didn't get much in the way of personalities before. I think that's more just the method everyone was approaching it with, that you saw GameSpot reviewed it at this number rather than Jeff Gerstmann for GameSpot. I mean, how did people learn Jeff Gerstmann's name? He got fired. I mean, that's really how it happened. Mm. Otherwise, I mean, it was GameSpot had that review.
So I get where that's coming from, but ultimately I try to dial it down to the idea of what's really the difference. So I love print. I'm a writer. I have been a writer for 20 years. I have written more than I care to think about at the moment. But all I've been trying to do through that medium is communicate things that I'm thinking, communicate ideas. Now, writing happens to give me a structure that I really enjoy, and it kind of forces me into usually being more concise than I would if I just was sitting and streaming something and I had the next 8 hours to do it. I don't think there's anything inherent, though, in the video medium or the podcast medium or the audio medium or the writing medium that doesn't say you can or can't structure your arguments. And I think hopefully, you know, at some point it may just, you know, it will get back to that a little bit, where there is some curation to be doing and there is some editing and there is some structure to put in there. There's this great YouTuber that I just started watching. And it's not even video games. I want to find it. It's actually this guy, who looks at movies, but looks at them in a really complicated way. I'm blanking. I'll have it here on the side. But what he does is he actually really curates these conversations really, really in an interesting way. Every Frame of Painting is what it's called. If you haven't checked it out and you're interested in like directors and how movies are structured, these are all like 8-minute videos or 7-minute videos where he has a topic that he covers and he analyzes it by showing the frames and that illustrate his point. Does something like he looks at Jackie Chan, he looks at Edgar Wright, he looks at David Fincher, he looks at, Kurosawa. And essentially what he's doing is using video to communicate a structured, intelligent, well-organized, well-thought-out idea. There's nothing fundamental about video or about necessarily even streaming that limits that. I mean, even your thing that you watched that was 2 hours long, it sounds like it was structured in a way that you might have just structured a mini book on it or a series of articles on it. And I don't want to vilify at all the medium just because a lot of people happen to be using it in this way right now. And again, I know you're not vilifying it, but you can kind of, it's easy for me to kind of look at YouTubers like Stampy, PewDiePie, that sort of trend and say, oh, this is all this is. Well, no, it can be many, many different things. And I don't think there's anything about it that says, this needs to die for this to be successful, or that if this dies, that means we've definitely, definitely lost something very important. I actually like the way that media and interaction and conversations evolves with the technology that supports it, because in the long run, as it continues to do so, it just ends up opening up more opportunities for ways people can connect with each other. There are things you can do with these videos that you can't do in writing, that you can't do in sitting down and creating articles. There's also a lot of things you can do in articles that you can't do over here. So I think as long as they don't completely overlap, there's actually going to be room for both.
Yeah. And honestly, I completely agree. And especially because the one thing you can never deny is the audience. I have people that listen to this podcast, do not follow my blog, and as far as I'm aware, do not follow my blog, do not watch my YouTube videos.
Yeah, we absolutely have that too.
And there, yeah, Game of the Job is actually a perfect example. I know there are a lot of people that listen to the podcast, not even members of the forums. Mm-hmm. A whole lot of people listening to the podcast aren't members of the forums. And then there's, members of the forums that don't even really read the front page, and then people like reading the front page that might not even take any of that in. When I first started reading Gamers with Jobs, actually, I mostly came for the front page content because I didn't have the ability to or comfortable setting to listen to the podcast. The podcast came later for me. So it really comes down to person. For some people, sitting down listening to a podcast, unless you're driving or unless you're at work, or as you do, Jerry, walking your dog, it's like a podcast just sitting there listening to people having a conversation, and that's the rest of the senses beg to be engaged as well. Versus, if you're just reading or if you're just watching a video. So I feel like saying, oh, YouTube's the future, writing is dead, I highly disagree.
Yeah.
Especially because, and that's one thing I'll tell you, in the past few years especially, I've done my regular old critical writing. I've done some of my little experimental prose writing on Gamers with Jobs. And then I've got my script writing for my YouTube series. And each of them is a very different approach. And I honestly couldn't tell you which one. Actually, no, I could tell you. It's either script writing or the prose that's the hardest to do. And it might actually be the script writing. Because when you have to consider the fact that you have to speak this stuff and that you have to put video with it, just plain old writing is actually, I think, going to stick around just because you can produce a good quality work faster than having to write a script, record it, and then put all the video together.
Yeah.
So,
and that's the thing. I think the way I look at it is that I do think in some ways YouTube is – I think YouTube is maybe challenging, to a certain degree, certain forms of written games coverage, and I do think it's challenging it in a degree that some people are either denying or just kind of putting their heads in the sand about, but at the same time, I don't think it's going to completely supplant it, and I hope it doesn't, because I think, as you guys have said, there are some things that can be done well with video, there are some things that are done better in writing, there are some things where video and writing can complement each other in an actually really interesting way. And that's the thing. I think video coverage of games in this way is a very good thing to add to the mix, but I don't think either would be good to I think they both have value. I don't think it would be good at all if either one supplanted the other one entirely. Yeah. I think YouTube is going to require a lot of the written content to I think it's going to change it and probably require, the type of stuff that's made and how it's produced and at what frequency to change and adapt. But I think the idea that it's going to render it wholly obsolete is a little bit premature, because what happened with online versus print media, right, is that it was both still written content. It just changed how it was delivered, for the most part, and the frequency at which stuff was able to get out there. YouTube stuff is a whole other type of way of expressing that information, and I don't think it's necessarily going to have the same impact. It's going to have an impact, but I can't see it completely killing off a previous form of it. It's just yeah, I think it's going to add to it, but I don't see it taking it out. But I do think some of the things with regards to how reviews are done, and Jeff Gerstmann's sort of talked about this on some of their videos a little bit, and some of his Q&A stuff that he does, is that even Giant Bomb is sort of rethinking how they approach reviews in certain ways, because he said that, yeah, with the way video coverage works and the way Let's Plays work, reviews in this sort of traditional way they've gone about it are not necessarily that effective anymore, because they can't convey the level of information that you can by even just watching someone play the game and not even talk about it critically, but you're just sort of witnessing how it works in that case. And he said they weren't planning to get rid of reviews, but they have to figure out how to adapt them to make them more applicable in that situation. And I think that's the kind of thing we're going to see more of, is less, well, we just can't do this anymore, so much as, well, we just got to do this differently.
Yeah, I'll make kind of one last point. To my mind, when I hear somebody say that, you know, a thing has begun to fade because this new thing is available, it makes me wonder, okay, was the only reason that thing was successful was because there was no alternative that people liked more? Or, you know, to the point where I would argue that the quickest way to kill a medium is not by creating something that challenges a bit, but by actually providing no challenge to it. That stagnates it, that forces it, you know, that allows it to grow comfortable in its own, you know, itself. I would argue that to some degree, this is to my mind what happened with television. There was really, I mean, yeah, movies were out, I mean, obviously movies were out there, but for a long time there was no challenge to television. There was nothing else in there that kind of fit that space. And, you know, over the 80s and the 90s and the, you know, early, you know, to some degree, even the early 2000s, television got crap. Like, for the most part, it was not, I mean, you'd have the Seinfeld here and there, and you'd have some shows that were good, but it became sort of self-obsessed and, you know, and really kind of, you know, just like, well, what else are you gonna do? Sit down and watch television. I would argue that even though maybe the viewership of television overall is down, right now, we're sort of in a television renaissance. You have shows like Breaking Bad and Mad Men and Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead and Count Louie and all these shows that never, ever would have existed if the medium hadn't been challenged by something else that came along and provided an alternative. You know, the industry itself, the kind of old school economic model for it may not be as successful, but I don't connect the idea of television is a medium with its economic structures that were sort of self-referential for years and years. So I actually think I'm actually up on writing. You know, it's there's not only isn't writing going to go away, but it's going to these other sort of competitors to it that provide this other medium and this other evaluation, force it to reevaluate itself and say, what is the unique thing this medium can provide that no other can, and how do we make people want to consume that? So it's going to be, you know, kind of painful at times, and we're going to lose some great writers and some great outlets, no question. But I think that kind of that culling, that challenge, is what will, you know, what in the long run keeps it fresh and keeps it trying new things that are more interesting than if it had nothing to compete against.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, is that this sort of transition period is going on right now, and I think this is what has so many people hand-wringing and so many people kind of worried and concerned, is because this change is in progress, and people still aren't – it isn't far enough along that people necessarily totally know what to make of it yet, so there's still a lot of like, oh, God, what's going on? But I think this will – start to normalize and start to shake out over the next little while, and I think at that point we'll start to see that one is not necessarily doomed, it's just things are evolving, and mm-hmm. which is probably not a bad thing in the grand scheme of things, but it's just, that's the thing. YouTube is both so new and rose to prominence at such a staggeringly quick pace that it kind of caught everybody off guard, except for a few people who saw it early on, and those people are, and everyone else is still kind of going, oh God, what, this is happening too quickly. But I think this, that will level with time, I think.
And there's still so much that I think could still be said, because there's so much that I was expecting to discuss and we never touched on, but it is time to, I think, wrap up. I will say I might do an episode one day of just discussing how we approach game reviews in general. And you can actually get a little glimpse of that if you check out my blog, www.gamertag.net. I have a piece up there, should still be relatively close to the front page. Let's Talk Games Writing Review Scores. I do discuss in a lot of ways what is the purpose of a review score? How does it serve that outlet? How does it serve why are they writing the review? And that's what it really comes down to is, I think in this regard, like, people are looking at, you know, stuff like YouTube, and they're asking themselves, if Giant Bomb's asking themselves, like, well, how do we fix our approach? I feel like the games industry has been stuck in a rut, and this is how a games review works. This is how you write it. That's what it is. And now we're suddenly reaching a point where I think a lot of people are wondering, wait a minute, is this really how it should be? So you can get some of my thoughts there, and of course, also check out youtube.com/user/ramblepack64. You can go to facebook.com/ramblepack64 and, of course, find my writing and that of Sean Sands at www.gamerswithjobs.com. Anything else you want people to find you at, Sean?
Don't want to add to the podcast competition, but you can also find the Gamers with Jobs conference call. Otherwise, nothing else.
Which, of course, you know, like and review us or the conference call on iTunes.
No, like and review got you guys first. Seriously.
But like and review us, leave a comment on the Facebook page or email ramblepack64@gmail.com. That's ramblepack, no C, just a K, 64@gmail.com. And Jerry, where can everyone find you?
Easiest place to sort of aggregate off to all my stuff is geekbravado.com. I've put a couple of blog posts up there recently. I was really swamped with a work project for a while, so I haven't put as much up on YouTube lately as I normally would have, but I did a retro flashback on Bruce Lee for the Commodore 64 a little while ago, and I hope to have another video up by the end of this weekend. I'll see how that goes. I did a whole whack of live streaming of Bloodborne, which I'm still doing on occasion because I'm still going through Chalice Dungeons in that game. So I'm doing that, but you can find all links to all that stuff off of geekbravado.com. And there's, I've been a little content light lately, but there'll probably be more coming soon.
All right. So there you have it, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and thank you both for joining me.
Thanks very much.
Intro and outro music performed by Arm Cannon. Visit www.armcannon.com for more.